love shopping local but short on time. With shopstogether.com, you can order from a range of independent shops on Bristol's famous Gloucester Road, and we will deliver to you. We currently deliver to BS6 and BS7 Tuesday to Friday, with more Bristol postcodes coming soon. Shopstogether.com, supported by Ujima Radio and BCFM as part of the One Love Breakfast, bringing local food home.
Hi, I'm DJ Spungold. Tune in to the Baby Boomtown Show every Friday at midnight to hear hidden gems of music across the genres, old and new. One love, one nation. Love BCFM.
And if they fire the first shot and the militia moves against them legitimately and lawfully to restore constitutional Republican government, and they bring the military against us, the entire American population will support us.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Ape Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Losing one jet might be unfortunate, but two might be carelessness. Is it just coincidence a second passenger load of people on Malaysian Airlines have met their doom? What real evidence is there about who shot this plane down and who had what to gain from it? We also speak with, former MI5 officer Annie Machon, who explains how, under former Defence Secretary Sir Malcolm Rifkind and the Tory government, there's no real oversight left. The intelligence services in this part of the world can pretty much do what they want. Doesn't sound like the WMD lessons from Iraq have been learnt, does it? Plus, tomorrow's march in Bristol City Centre in support of the people of Palestine. Although the US was the first country to recognise the State of Israel way back in 1947, Palestine conflict was arguably a problem Britain created. The Israelis call it mowing the grass. Every few years, going into Gaza and the West Bank to trim down the population. But is it a war crime? How much responsibility does Britain bear, and why do our leaders seem so silent on the slaughter of civilians by the Israeli military over the last 3 weeks? Also, journalist Dan Glazebrook's been in town this week, and I spoke to him about his new book, Divide and Ruin. No, not Divide and Rule, Divide and Ruin. The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. But we start this week with yesterday's downing of a Malaysian Airlines jet, actually pretty much identical to the one that disappeared back in March as it was heading for Kuala Lumpur, from Kuala Lumpur over to Beijing. Martin, what are your thoughts about initially about what's happened here, what we know, and various lines which are being spun around the world's press about it?
Well, obviously, the Western media have jumped immediately on the bandwagon that this is Russian separatists probably working on instructions from Moscow, who've shot down this aeroplane because they're terribly nasty people and we're going to have to go to war with them. I'm afraid I don't really know what happened, and I think we're still working out what happened. But certainly, as I've been looking around on the internet, certain anomalies have started to appear. For example, that the jet had been rerouted from its normal route. It doesn't normally fly over Donetsk and Luhansk. It normally flies over Crimea. And this week, or today, it decided it was going to fly somewhere differently.
That's a fascinating fact. Rerouted. What can we draw from that? Because, I mean, this is a war zone, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's possibly... But what I was reading, they were suggesting that it was rerouted because of the row between Russia and Ukraine about air traffic control. Therefore, they don't want it to fly over Crimea because they're not sure how to hand it over. I also read that it was being escorted by Ukrainian fighters until a couple of minutes before it was shot down. All the other things I've read suggest that...
Okay, let's just stop you there for a second, because, of course, it could be that there was an attempt to shoot the fighters down. They missed and hit the airliner.
Possibly. I mean, let's put it this way. If it was the separatist rebels who shot it down, then they won't have intended to shoot it down. And I think that was the point being made by Putin when he said, look, there's a fighting going on in Ukraine.
But that's not good enough, is it? Sorry,
no,
we hit the wrong plane.
No, but at the same time, let's just assume the worst, and that it was them and they did do it, but they did it by accident. There shouldn't be fighting in the East Ukraine at all. There is no justification in my mind for the Ukrainian National Guard, backed up by paramilitaries from Pravi Sector and Svoboda, to invade the East Ukraine where they had referendums on independence from Kiev.
Now, well, they would say those referendums were illegal and that's part of their country.
Yes, but that's what that, and the Kosovans said exactly the same thing, but Britain went to war with Serbia to force them to accept Kosovan independence. And what I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia, and there were various ceasefires, attempts to try and find solutions and so on. The West have not looked for any kind of solution here at all. They've just basically encouraged the Kiev government. And the IMF, for example, said to them that they wouldn't get an IMF loan unless they took re-control of the east of the Ukraine, including the Crimea, basically shooing them forwards from behind. Now, ultimately, I don't think that they are going to... These regions are not going to be part of the Ukraine in the long run. They're just not. I mean, if you look what happened in Sri Lanka when the Sri Lankan army crushed the Tamil Tigers a couple of years ago, killing thousands and thousands of civilians, they had an election in the region a year later, and the Tamil Tigers political wing won overwhelmingly. And after all of the civilians that have been killed by the Kiev junta and its paramilitary allies now, I cannot see anybody in that region voting to be part of the Ukraine in any long-term way.
Okay,
so in other words, there's no justification for fighting.
Within the first few hours of the plane coming down, there were all sorts of theories about what might have brought it down, whether it was a missile, air-to-ground missile, a surface-to-air missile fired from the Black Sea, or possibly a bomb on board, but it's now become pretty clear that it was one of these Buk missile batteries, that's BUK, an old Soviet era ground-to-air missile system, quite a sophisticated one, that was designed back in the late 1970s. So this is quite an old, probably a modernised version of it, but actually quite an old system, but actually fairly sophisticated, not the kind of thing that was around previously. One of the things that bothers me, though, is it feasible that the Ukrainian central government in Ukraine actually cleared this airspace and said it's okay to fly through here? Because that seems to be what happened. The biggest mystery for me is what on earth that aircraft was doing there. I imagine, I don't know about you, Martin, but if you were sitting on an aircraft and you were watching the moving map on the seat in front and you started heading towards Donetsk and that sort of area, you would be thinking, well, we've had 10 aircraft shot down here within the last few weeks. What on earth are we doing flying over there?
Yeah, but all of those 10 aircraft, helicopters and other aircraft that have been shot down by manpads, that is to say, by handheld...
And heavy machine guns, yeah.
Yeah, by handheld stuff, which doesn't actually reach up to the, 10,000 metres, 30,000 feet that the aeroplane was flying on. So, fairly clearly, it was either shot down from the air by an aeroplane, or it was shot down from the ground by a fairly sophisticated
system. Well, OK, the reason I say that it was one of these Buk missile batteries is that the Russians have announced that they have satellite-tracked the radar for one of these Buk missile batteries, and they believe it is exactly this is exactly what shot it down in the village of Styla, Styla, which is just near Donetsk, just outside Donetsk, about 20 miles or 15 miles outside Donetsk. And so I would be very interested to be wandering around Styla today, knocking on a few doors and say, did you see one of these missile batteries around here yesterday? Yeah, well, and if so, who were they?
Yeah, well, the fact of the matter is that what I was also reading was that the Ukrainian prosecutor in Kiev was saying that he knows that the rebels haven't got access to these systems, and because they are quite sophisticated systems, you need a crew of 15, they need to be trained to be using
them. Okay, well, the Russian TV network Zvezda, that TV is reporting that the Buk one of these Buk systems fell to the separatists' hands on the 29th of June this year. Now, you can imagine, if you're in the desperate situation these separatists are, you come across a wonderful piece of military kit like this, the temptation is, of course, to use it.
Yeah, well, in other words, what we need to have is a proper investigation and find out what actually happened here. But, of course, the other possibility, given what's previously happened in the Ukraine, the shootings in the Maidan Square, which were pretty definitely carried out by Pravi Sector, in other words, not by the Yanukovych regime, but by the new regime, they killed the protesters and the police officers, and of course the massacre in Odessa, which was organised by Andrei Poribi and other of far-right paramilitaries in Ukraine, they would be quite capable of shooting down an airliner in order to blacken the name of the separatists. I'm not saying they did, I'm just saying they're quite capable of doing that. And it may be, when we get to the bottom of it, that that's what happened.
Okay, look, Martin, I mean, this is quite a controversial comment to make, because it seems to me a bit unlikely, but what could they stand to gain by that?
Because what they're trying to do is draw the West into a conflict with the Russians, just as they were trying to get us into a war with Syria this time last year. Incidentally, it's now become very clear that the chemical weapons attack in Ghouta def- definitely wasn't carried out by Assad. Seymour Hersh's article in the London Review of Books, and nobody's been able to refute him, shows that the Turks supplied Libyan sarin to the rebels with Saudi support.
That's the nerve gas. Yeah.
Yes. So in other words, after all the huffing and puffing about Assad using chemical weapons on his own people, it turns out to be the Turks and the Saudis who are using chemical weapons. When are we bombing Riyadh? Now, of course, what's happening here is we're being pushed to war with Syria, we're being pushed to war with Russia, and therefore people will create incidents like the sinking of the Lusitania in World War One, or the Pearl Harbor attack in 1942, which the British and the Americans knew was going to happen but allowed to happen in order to push isolationists off the fence inside the US. When these incidents happen, everybody has got to suspend judgment, and we've all got to get in and look at what the facts tell us. But let's just presume that what the Western media is saying is true, and that the rebels did have a hold of a book system, and they've managed to shoot down an airliner by accident, because I don't suppose they'd want to shoot down an airliner. The fact is, there are airstrikes going on all over East Ukraine against civilian targets at the moment. If you were the self-defense forces in Luhansk and Donetsk, and you've got airstrikes coming in against you, I mean, the Russian Air Force could say, we're going to do a no-fly zone over this region, as we did over, as Britain and France did.
Well, they'd have to go to the UN to do that.
Not necessarily. Well, yes, but they'd have to go to the UN, but they could say, well, we're sick of...
Americans would veto it.
Well, exactly.
It's pointless.
So, yes, but I'm just pointing out that when Assad does it and when Gaddafi does it, it's terrible. When the Kiev regime does it backed by the West, it's fine. In actual fact, did Britain carry out airstrikes in Northern Ireland when it was fighting so-called terrorists over many years? No, it didn't. How can you resist terrorism in the East Ukraine with airstrikes? It's totally inappropriate.
Okay, I'll go back to this business of the airspace being a war zone, having 10 aircraft shot down there beforehand, not really a very safe place for airliners to be flying around. I mean, compare this to the Ashcloud situation. That was almost a week. 10 million passengers were affected by that, just told simply, you can't fly. Why haven't they done that with the zone in Ukraine? Because literally you're talking about a few pennies worth of fuel for an aircraft on a 12-hour flight to just take a slight diversion one side or the other, so there's no need whatsoever to fly anywhere near Ukraine.
Well, as I said, this particular aircraft flies this route all the time, and it was actually flying differently from where it usually flies. It usually flew over Crimea, I believe, avoiding this region altogether. But it was rerouted on this occasion directly over the fighting. And of course, we need to look into that. Who made that decision and why?
Okay, another potential motive here, of course, is the massive decision, hardly reported really here in the West, which was the decision of the BRICS countries to set up a World Development Bank to compete with the World Bank and the IMF. Now, just tell us a little bit about the Bretton Woods Agreement at the end of World War II and how that's turned so horribly bad and sour over the ensuing decades.
Well, and there's a big topic, but the Bretton Woods Agreement set up the IMF, the World Bank, and what was then the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, which has become the World Trade Organization, dominated by the Western powers, very much in their interest, with the dollar as the reserve currency, but pegged to gold. But of course, the dollar was taken off gold in 1971 by Nixon so that he could print money to fight the Vietnamese without raising taxes, and the whole system started to unravel from that point. And certainly, it is the case that the BRICS countries are looking to liberate themselves from the US dollar. And of course, that means ultimately that what we're looking at here is a potential war between the BRICS countries and the NATO countries.
Why is that? I mean, surely you don't have a go to war just because you swap your bank account from one bank to another.
No, because it's all if the dollar stops being the world's reserve currency, the Americans will not be able to afford to fight the simultaneous wars on every continent.
Well, they'll just have to withdraw their forces, surely.
But they don't want to do that, do they? So, in other words, they have to go to war to keep the dollar as the reserve currency. And to do that, they need to take out the Russians, which could explain why they shoot down an airliner to blame the Russians, to go to war with the Russians, to take out the Russians, to keep the dollar as the reserve currency.
But, I mean, Russians are only one part of the BRICS countries, aren't they? There's actually quite a lot of major countries around the world now who have come together.
Well, they're ultimately planning to go to war with China, but they want to take Russia first.
But the other countries such as South Africa, Brazil, I mean, even if Russia does fall, as you're suspecting there, I mean, you know, I don't know if there's any truth to that, but there's not just one or two countries here in the BRICS. Do you think how much of a threat does this new development bank present to the Western powers and their financial
system?
Ultimately,
it presents a terminal threat. The Americans shouldn't have taken the dollar off gold in 1971. When they did that, they started to unravel the whole international system, and we're now living with the consequences of that. Ultimately, the BRICS countries would like to cooperate with the NATO countries, but in practice, they don't feel as if they can. And if you look at the way Putin's behaved in this crisis, he's bent over backwards to try and find negotiated solutions. He hasn't sent the Russian army into the Ukraine, and he's encouraged the people in Ukraine to negotiate with Kiev. But the West isn't interested. Powerful forces in the West want to see Assad removed in Syria. They want to see Putin removed in Russia. They want regime change in places like Venezuela, and so on. And they're not prepared to back down, so we're probably going to war.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Okay, we're going to discuss the situation over in Israel and Palestine now. And joining me in the studio is this Palestinian journalist based here now in Bristol, Iqbal Tamimi. Hi, Iqbal, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi.
First of all, I know you're quite critical of the way that the current conflict has been reported. Do you want to just take us through why that is? I think you're finding that the reporting of it is really not being correct or fair, and the ethics of it.
Well, this is the third week of attack in Gaza, and it was extremely shocking how the mainstream media has underplayed the whole issue and neglected the whole issue. You could hear the whole bulletin of the news, and you can't hear anything about Gaza and what is happening. Now that the majority of the British people now are using more media resources other than their local or their mainstream media, they know more now about what is happening in Gaza, and they are really disappointed and angry about what seems like complicity, between UK media and what is happening
okay.
in there.
Okay, give us an idea then of what you think we're not hearing.
Pardon?
What are we not hearing here? Tell us.
It's not just what you're not hearing. It's you are not updated, and the use of terms, the statements are all, if the issue is mentioned, are all by Israeli side. I couldn't hear any from the Palestinian side in Gaza, or somebody who could defend what is happening in Gaza.
Well, it's fair to say that, for example, Channel 4 News, some of the other major networks do have reporters in Gaza with their flak jackets on, who are, for example, I was watching Channel 4 News last night, and they had, I think it was Jonathan Miller, who said, well, we were in the middle of editing this report, and there was another massive attack just down the road.
Yeah, it came a little bit late, but the most criticised is BBC, because we depend on BBC as the oldest and ethical with traditions of journalism that we all respected for many years, and now many things are happening, and we are discovering that through media, which we never thought we will be now searching for to find about the news. Sometimes Russian TV, Iranian sources, small channels or websites are bringing more information than our own, main media.
Okay. What about Turkey, though? Because I know that apparently I imagine Egypt, too. A lot of the other Islamic countries, Arabic countries, are looking at what's happening, and they're extremely angry. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of action.
Well, they are angry for many reasons. One of it is that the attack came in the month of Ramadan, where people are supposedly, looking for peace. And the second thing is that it happened on civilians. The claims are usually that we have informed them to evacuate the areas, and everybody knows that Gaza is a strip that is the most densely populated in the world. There is no place to hide, and the attacks came on even children watching soccer games on the shore. Three of them were brothers, died while watching TV. So besides that, the Turks, it's not just they are Muslims. They have lost 10 of their people during an attack while they were helping delivering humanitarian aid a couple of years ago, and the issue is not yet resolved, as Israel did not apologize or compensated the families. So everybody is feeling strongly about it, and it seems that because Hezbollah, which used to be a little bit supportive of what is going in Gaza, now are busy with what is happening in Syria because they have another issue to defend or to be interested in. So the Gaza people are left on their own to fight without. Even the Arabs now, everybody knows that Ramadan is what we call the season of drama. All the drama is sold in the Arab region during Ramadan. This is the first year ever that we have over 200 dramas aired on TVs. Nothing mentions Palestine. Nothing. There is a big game going now.
Well, I mean, is that one of the reasons that there hasn't been so much coverage is because of this other story, which has sort of sidelined the Gaza story to a certain extent. But Iqbal, can you see from these what's been happening from an Israeli perspective too, that there are many people in Israel who are very worried, nervous about these rockets, even though, of course, they're not guided, they're quite old-fashioned rockets, being fired indiscriminately from Gaza?
Well, the people of Gaza started making rockets just a few years ago, while Israel has been the strongest fourth army in the world since 65 years. It took the Palestinians something like 60 years to think of manufacturing homemade rockets to defend themselves when the international community has failed them. And anybody, if somebody comes to your home, kick your children out, beat you, take your home, after a while, even if you are the most, polite person, you'll get angry at some time. I want to defend your children or your property. You'll try to do anything to defend yourself, especially when your neighbors don't care and your friends don't care and nobody, and you find yourself fighting on your own.
Martha, Old Labour Oxford economist Martha Summers, just want to bring you in here because I noticed just a few weeks ago your leader, Ed Miliband, was one of the major speakers at the Labour Friends of Israel's annual get-together, and he was really talking about how, the story was the 17th of June, this is last month actually, Miliband pledges closer ties to Israel if he leads a new Labour government. The future Labour government would forge closer links with Israel, Ed Miliband pledged in a speech to the annual Labour Friends of Israel luncheon in London. He praised Israel's economic achievements, democracy and high-tech innovations. The Labour leader also called for a two-state solution, calling the building of settlements in the occupied territories a significant threat to negotiated agreement, and described ISIS as a violent and brutal military group posing a threat to the entire region. So it's a seem that Ed Miliband, one of the reasons he's been quite quiet about what's been happening in Palestine, Israel over the last few weeks, is that he is nailing his colours very much to the Israeli mast.
I'm afraid that's true. He's probably less pro-Israeli than his brother, David Miliband, who is not the Labour leader. But I'm afraid he is too close to them. One of the things he told the Israeli lobby when he became leader, that he would oppose boycott and disinvestment in Israel. And there are many forces within the Labour Party and the trade unions who are actually in favour of boycott and disinvestment of Israel. So he's nailed his colours to that mast. I think what he's got to watch out for is, as a person of Jewish origin, he's got to be seen to be totally even-handed and fair on this issue. And he should perhaps take his cue from Gerald Kaufman, who is also Jewish, who has been extremely critical of the Israeli state and is extremely critical of this recent barbarism that we're experiencing.
Iqbal, I mentioned at the top of the hour this term cutting the grass, which apparently the Israeli military use. Every few years they have to go into Gaza or the West Bank and actually trim down the population a bit. That's the way the military apparently talk about it. Is that something you're familiar with?
I don't think you can call it cutting grass, because you allow the grass to grow a little bit before cutting again, which is not Israel doing. Their attacks are continuous, but the big ones looks like cutting grass procedure, while Israel is now collectively punishing families, full people, civilians, for rockets. I mean, it's just few minutes ago, the Guardian is updating its web page about Gaza. There is a man with two babies, two daughters, babies, both were injured by shelled by Israel. I mean, how can you justify that?
Well, it's not easy, is it? Martin, how do they justify it?
Well, what's happened, if you think back over this process, there were the three teenagers supposedly kidnapped, although the Israeli security forces later admitted that they knew they were dead. And, of course, Mossad actually spoke to the cabinet in Israel the week before, said, what would we do if three teenagers were kidnapped? And then, by sheer coincidence, three teenagers were kidnapped. And then the Palestinian boy was burned to death. And then the Israelis used all of this as an excuse to hit Hamas.
But this is the wrong thing. It did not start with killing those three Jewish boys, because just a week before, many Palestinian children were killed. But the media picks from Israel. Point of view from that point on.
Well, ultimately, the real politics of this is the rapprochement between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. They'd formed the unity government. The Israelis are very unhappy with that. So all of this is essentially to disrupt the relations between Hamas and Abu Mazen. And this is all politics, but of course the ultimate effect is this humanitarian disaster. And of course the role of the military regime in Egypt has been pretty. They've sealed the Rafah crossing. They're hostile to Hamas as well. And the whole region. Ed Miliband mentioned ISIS earlier. I mean, ISIS grew out of the Western powers' support for the overthrow of Assad. We know that in Jordan they were training these people some weeks ago, and now they're the world's worst enemy. I'm afraid the Western powers and the Israelis have often played these kind of psychological warfare games, where they turn one group against another group, and it's part of a bigger strategy to dominate and control.
As the airliner story exploded onto the news last night, the Israelis announced, I don't know if they announced it, but certainly they began a ground incursion as well. Many people have been killed there in hospitals and elsewhere. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, who's an Israeli military spokesman, told The Guardian that the operation is open-ended, that the ground forces in Gaza may be there for a long time. He says, we will be striking the infrastructure. We will be striking the operatives in order to safeguard the civilians of the State of Israel, especially issues to do with tunnelling. That was exemplified earlier today. Our forces, large ground forces, accompanied by massive air force support, naval forces and intelligence, are taking over targets in Gaza, operating against tunnels and terror activists and infrastructure, Israel's chief military spokesman, Brigadier General Moti Almoz, said. He called on Gaza residents to evacuate all areas, warning the military is operating there with very great force. This isn't very good news for the Palestinian people. I just wonder if you're in touch with people there and what you think, what will be going through their minds. If you can, take us into the mindset of the Palestinian today.
I think the Palestinians there don't trust anybody anymore. They feel desperate because they know that it's all just a facade. They keep saying that we are helping, building the infrastructure. They get few pounds from here and there donations. And as soon as it's built, it is knocked down by Western-created machinery implanted in the military Israeli vehicles and army equipment. So this is, they know it's been going on for so many years, and there is no way out of this but to boycott Israel totally on every way until it respects the international humanitarian opinion about respecting human life.
Can you just tell us what life is like there? How is it different to here, for example?
Well, first of all, they don't have water. They don't have energy, electricity. It's very hot. When you cut the electricity, even if you have a little bit of food in your fridge, it's rotten. And we all know how very difficult it is to get food in Gaza under such curfews. People are... It's very, very... densely populated areas. They don't have somewhere to hide. Unlike Israel, they have, areas of under the ground. They have places to hide civilians or, to protect them. They can't also use their own seashores. They can't use their airspace or their ports or airport. So it's on every way they are dead alive. It's like sardines living in a tin. What do you expect of them? I mean, I would say that I wouldn't be, exaggerated if I say that all of them are going mad and anything they would do might be justified.
Martin, why is there nobody, it seems, anywhere in the world who will come to the aid of the Palestinian people, particularly Britain, since we created this situation back in 1947?
Well, I would say that the Israelis should be read the riot act, basically. They should get.
Yeah, but who by? I mean, nobody seems to be prepared to do it.
Ultimately, they should be read the riot act by people like Britain and the US, but that's not going to happen. Ultimately, of course, Hamas are the elected leadership of the Palestinian people. They should have been negotiated with. They should negotiate with them now. The Hamas, in fact, has demonstrated a capacity to negotiate, a capacity to deliver ceasefires. They're definitely worth talking to. They should be talking to them. And the Israelis should be made to talk to them. And ultimately, the state of Israel, if it really does insist on being outside humanitarian law, then the question of whether the state should exist at all can start to be asked. I mean, the West is now saying that you can't have a state in the East Ukraine and we're going to carry on bombing and shooting and killing you until you give up your idea of having an independent state in the East Ukraine. Ultimately, that might have to be done with the Israelis. There's no absolute right for a state to exist, especially a settler state. Don't forget that many of the people in Gaza were actually born in Jaffa, just up the road. That's where they originally come from, not from Gaza at all.
At least 240 Palestinians is the latest figure I can find.
271.
Is it? Yeah. In Israeli airstrikes and other incursions since the 8th of July, many of them children, according to medics in Gaza. Senior Hamas official Ghazi Hamad said Islamist Palestinian movement refused to accept the Cairo proposal in its current form and is seeking a series of conditions for a truce with Israel. So maybe you can just explain the mindset of that. I mean, surely if there's a peace proposal on the table in this sort of situation, Iqbal, Hamas should be taking it.
At the moment, even the Egyptians themselves don't trust their own government. And there is some kind of a foggy, let's say, political atmosphere over Egypt now. The fact is the Arab world is now tormented between fighting powers. Some are drawn to Saudi Arabia's leadership and the others towards the Qatari leadership. And both of those have power and money. And so how can they care about, let's say, the Palestinians who have nothing? They would care about economy. They would care about oil and buying military equipments and army training more than caring about the Palestinians. I mean, the Palestinians have been suffering for 66 years, and I can't tell you that there is a decade that I could say that the Arab world cared about.
Martin, I'm going to ask you again, why is no one stepping up to the plate to defend these civilians from a military assault? We're told by The Guardian the thousands of Israeli soldiers have massed on the border with Gaza in recent days waiting for the order to go in. Israel called up nearly 50,000 reserve soldiers.
Well, let's ask the question, what if Morsi had not been overthrown in Egypt and you didn't have Sisi in power in Egypt? It might be that Egypt might declare war against Israel in these circumstances, but they won't because you've got a military dictatorship backed by the West. So there you've got it.
Do you think there's any hope for the Palestinian people at the moment, Iqbal?
The only hope they have is that if there becomes some ethical awakening in the West, and this can happen by the pressures of the ordinary person, when they elect their own representatives at the parliament, they should elect carefully somebody who has let's say, an ethical background, that they care about their own country, because the world is a little village. It's no more that this, far areas are not our own concern. Everything, goes round, and violence will be circulated one way or another, and it will come back on us. For everybody's sake, we should all try to help calm down everything and make peace accessible.
Okay, well, you don't need to be Muslim to stand up for Gaza. That's a demonstration taking place tomorrow, Saturday, 19th of July. Assemble at 12 noon by the Shah Jalal Mosque. That's just under the M32 behind Monte Carlo Cafe on Stapleton Road, Eastern and Bristol. That's just on the junction with Robertson Road, the traffic lights there. And then there'll be a march to College Green, and that's organised by Bristol for Palestine. So that is definitely happening tomorrow, and let's hope that we get some sort of somebody sort of stops the Israeli military from killing people, because it seems that it's a completely one-sided battle that's going on there.
I hope we will see some coverage at least through our local media of such protests.
Okay, Iqbal Tamimi, Palestinian journalist living now here in Bristol, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Annie Machon is a former MI5 officer who blew the whistle back in 1998. Here she is at the Independence from America Day celebrations, which were held up at Minworth Hill in North Yorkshire a few weeks ago, explaining some of the amazing effects that the Edward Snowden revelations have had, and also looking at the oversight, which we've been talking about earlier on, of our security services by MP Malcolm Rifkind.
Even in Russia, if there's a whistleblowing case, the whistleblower goes to prison, sure, not a nice prison, but the journalists are specifically protected by the Constitution of Russia. So we are worse than Russia, democratically. That's how bad, that's how far we've slid over the last 10 years. And it's interesting, I think, looking at the coverage of the Snowden files. You know, Snowden, a brave young man, someone who knew what he was facing by going public, 35 years in prison. At least. Someone who knew when he went public that the fake kangaroo court that tried Chelsea Manning had just started and Manning was going to prison for 35 years. And someone who knew also that his predecessor, whistleblower from the NSA, a man called Thomas Drake, who had indeed gone through all the correct channels up to and including a congressional hearing in America, had then been had his house raided and been threatened with 35 years in prison. So it doesn't matter how you try and do it, how you try and follow the rules, they will still threaten you with a life in prison. And he knew all this. And he still stepped forward and did what he did. And hats off to him. I think he is the most significant whistleblower of modern history, because what he has exposed affects all of us globally, affects every citizen of the world. And without him, we would not have a chance of pushing back. So he did this, and we need to give as much support back to him, I think, as we can, and use the information that he provided to us. But of course, in Britain, it's not so easy to get that information necessarily from the mainstream media, because it was censored. It was banned under a D notice. And that's why we haven't had the coverage or the outpouring of anger here in the way that I've seen in other European countries, and particularly Germany, which is a very interesting place to live at the moment with its collective historical memories of the Gestapo, of what it was like to live under the Stasi. And this is why it has such a strong constitution trying to rein in the abuses of the spies. And the spies in Germany have some nasty questions to answer now. Were they colluding with the NSA with the knowledge of their political masters, and the politicians say no? Or were they acting rogue, which is what the politicians are implying, so they will be reined in? Why that cannot happen here, I do not know, apart from the strange James Bond mythology that glamorises spying in Britain. We've always been the goodies. We think we're always on the good side, the winning side of history, and our spies will protect us and not go against us. That is a load of crap. So, how should they be reined in? At the moment, the situation, the accountability situation, is appalling. It is the weakest out of any notional Western democracy. It's even worse than America. We have a situation here where MI5 is supposedly regulated by the 1989 Official Secrets Act, where MI6 and GCHQ, the listening post, the formerly secret agency, which now has been spread all over the world's media, thank you, where they were put on a legal footing in 1994 with the Intelligence Services Act, which crucially at the time also put in place in Parliament a committee called the Intelligence and Security Committee, which was supposed to have oversight responsibility of the spies. And that was a wonderful fig leaf. The politicians were really pleased with this move. They said, that's great, you know, we know what they're doing. It turned out that in 1994, the only powers that the ISC had were to look at policy, finance, and administration of the spies. They had no powers to call for witnesses. They had no powers to call for papers. They were not allowed to investigate allegations of operational wrongdoing or crime. And the spies loved it. They were cock-a-hoop when that law went through. Yes, we'd got away with it. I remember, I was there. And it has been proven since that indeed they did get away with it, and they have got away with it, because time and time again, top spooks have lied to this committee, and it's now on the record.
Annie Machon there, former MI5 officer, speaking at Independence from America Day. Martin, the picture she's painting there is of a intelligence service in this country which is massively, massively funded, but totally out of control.
I think that's true, and you've got to recognise that MI6, for example, were the lead agency on setting up Operation Cyclone, which was the seed corn for Al-Qaeda. But we still think of them as James Bond, as she says. They're not James Bond. They're basically involved in lots of nasty stuff all over the world, and they have been for a very long time.
OK, we're going to go over now to hear from Dan Glazebrook. He was in Bristol this week, and I spoke to him about his new book, Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis.
My name's Dan Glazebrook. I'm a journalist, and I've had a book out. And the book's called Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. My argument in the book is that we're actually in a kind of new phase now that's driven by the number of crises. We're not so much in a phase of divide and rule so much as what I call the book Divide and Ruin. Because if you look at during the Cold War, for example, or even before the Cold War, going to the kind of classic imperialist era in the 19th century, the European powers and later America as a kind of new imperialist power operated this divide and rule principle, where they tried to control countries by making alliances with certain factions within the country. And what I think we're seeing now is that there are a number of crises affecting this kind of 500-year-old kind of imperial system, if you like, whereby it's difficult to control countries anymore. It's difficult to control them economically because you've got the rise of China. So Western financial institutions are really unable to, or at least unwilling, to compete with the kind of terms of trade offered by the Chinese. So you're seeing increasingly African countries going to China for finance, for mining, offering them mineral rights because the Chinese just offer far, far superior deals. So that means that Britain and US and France and these kind of old imperial powers are losing their kind of economic leverage. So this is one element of the crisis. And then on a military level as well, they're trying to turn to using their military because their economic power is declining. But the insurgencies in Afghanistan and Iraq have really crippled their military ability as well, and have really destroyed their capacity to wage long-term ground invasions and occupations. So this new strategy, I think, is they're accepting that they can no longer control powerful regional powers as they once could by propping up client states, people like Saddam Hussein in Iraq or Mobutu in the Congo. This kind of era is over because if they allow these strong states to exist, then their loyalty cannot be depended on. They're likely to turn to China, who offers better deals and so on. So divide and ruin is kind of trying to get across the idea that they're actually deliberately sowing divisions in countries in order to keep them crippled and to prevent anyone from coming to power. So if you look at what's happened to Iraq, to Libya, even to Syria to an extent, I don't think this is an accident that they've been turned into failed states effectively by NATO and their allies. This is, I think, their kind of plan B, that if they can't control these countries, then it's a kind of slash and burn policy. Well, we'll leave them a big failed state mess so that at least they're not acting as regional independent powers that are a counterweight to our influence, that ally with our enemy China, and so on and so forth. So I think that's a very real reality and a very dangerous development.
Now, it sounds a little bit similar to a few years ago we had Naomi Klein's book, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. I just wonder what you think the point of all this is. You can't actually use a country if it's in ruins. All you can do is deny it to others.
Yeah, that is effectively what I'm saying. I mean, I haven't read this book, Disaster Capitalism. I've read some of the things she's written in terms of articles, and my understanding is that what she's arguing, which I'd agree with, is that that when there are disasters befalling a country, military invasions or whatever it is, when people are in a state of shock, that's used then as a kind of a way of ramming down those countries' throats, kind of neoliberal policies of total opening up of their economies to total exploitation by foreign companies and ending kind of public services and this kind of thing. And I agree with all that, but what I'm saying is kind of going beyond that. So it's, I'm saying that it's also about, yeah, on the one hand, you're right, it's driven by the kind of desire to deny any possible rivals of Western capitalism the chance to develop relations with particular countries. But it's also driven by the other aspect of the crisis we haven't discussed yet, which is the financial economic crisis beginning in 2007 and 2008, which in Marxist terms, I think you can see it as a classic, what's called a kind of overproduction crisis, where there's, I mean, one thing that this crisis economically is not about is a lack of money. The problem, actually, if you look at the economics behind these kind of crises, is that there's too much money. The big corporations, the wealthy holders of capital, have huge amounts of cash, huge amounts of capital, and their problem is they have nowhere profitable to invest it, because the people they want to sell it to, in other words, the world's population, are too poor to basically buy the products that they want to sell. So this leads to what's called a kind of overproduction crisis. Factories get closed down because they can't sell their goods and so on, and this makes the problem worse, as then you have even more poor people kind of thrown on the scrap heap of unemployment, unable to buy goods, and it gets worse and worse. And I think what they're trying to do then, also another thing they're trying to do with destabilizing countries, is create markets for rebuilding countries. I mean, you know, the kind of construction contracts in Libya, reconstruction, they completely bombed Libya. Then there was the new government that they imposed by force, then was allocating contracts worth $300 billion to reconstruct the country. So if you destroy countries, that creates one profitable, very profitable avenue for investment in rebuilding what you've just destroyed. And another element of, if you have a perpetual kind of failed state like Libya now at war of itself, no prospect of any viable security anytime in the future, what that means is rich people with assets to protect, they have to turn to private security for protecting their homes and their investments and their oil fields and these kinds of things. Those are the kind of services that were once provided by a state, in a failed state, have to be provided by private security. And who's the world leaders in providing private security? Britain and the US. They're losing their competitive edge in all other industries and technologies, but this is the one they remain world leaders, as well as the arms trade more generally, which of course also benefits from generalized insecurity. So I think it's also about creating markets to try and overcome this kind of financial and economic crisis as well. By making people have to pay their own private security companies for security indefinitely into the future, because there's no state capacity to provide security.
On your economic side, we've seen this week the BRICS countries talking about and actually taking the first proper steps towards setting up a competitor, really, to the World Bank. Does that mean that the Bretton Woods system that was set up after World War II has failed? Because the idea was that this was a world system, and many countries around the world are saying actually that is broken too. I wonder if you could just talk about, you know, if you think it's broken, and if so, why?
Well, absolutely, you're right in saying this is a rival to the World Bank and the so-called Bretton Woods institutions, which includes the International Monetary Fund. And this is only, I mean, I don't think that, you know, the IMF is not going to be finished off by this, but what it's going to have to do, and the World Bank is also going to have to do, which is good news by any standard, is going to have to really up its game to compete for business. It's going to have to actually start offering, you know, something other than just indefinite growing debts to people. If you look in the 1990s, after the collapse of the Cold War, but before the kind of rise of China really massively took off, that was the era when International Monetary Fund really had the monopoly, and Western financial institutions really had the monopoly on providing loans and finance to governments around the world. And that was a disaster, because they really used that power, that monopoly power that they had, to really turn the screw on already heavily indebted, poverty-stricken countries across Africa and Asia and so on. And so they would make conditions, this era of what we call the structural adjustment programs, where governments who needed loans, and they were usually loans, by the way, to pay off earlier debts with very extortionate interest rates that had been lent by the same institutions. And their conditions for providing these loans would be, you know, crippling for the countries. There'll be things like, oh, you have to remove all subsidies for your farmers, remove all subsidies for your industry. So whole swathes of industry and farming were destroyed. You have to remove tariffs, that is, taxes on foreign imports. So places were flooded with you know, cotton or rice, and all of those cotton or rice farmers put out of business and so on. It really, these structural adjustment policies led to a massive growth in the kind of slum population, really, as farmers forced off their land, people thrown out of work and so on. It was a really devastating time. Public spending cut, you know, the AIDS epidemic grew massively throughout this period because people had to cut back on their education programs, health education, healthcare.
Don't let me interrupt you, because why has it taken so long for a competitor to the World Bank and the IMF, since it's caused such devastation right across the developing world?
Well, in a sense, there was a competitor before. There was the Soviet Union, which was, you know, which would provide engineers and healthcare workers and so on to countries around the world. So it was just, there was this kind of blip, really, in the 90s, before China really became... I mean, China's had this policy for a long time of trying to rise without really anyone noticing. So they've avoided doing anything that might be seen as kind of provocative or trying to muscle in the West field. You know, they're very nervous about kind of creating enemies unnecessarily, if you like. But I think now that, you know, we've gone beyond that. And, you know, US is openly now, with this pivot to Asia, so-called, openly, you know, basically trying to surround and intimidate China. And I think they're thinking, well, you know, it's kind of a bit late for, like, keeping our nose down and hoping no one notices we're here. So we may as well do something useful. And they've already been effectively acting as a kind of banker, in a sense, even before the official BRICS bank was set up. In terms of the business deals they've been doing in places like Africa, providing infrastructure in the form of housing, hospitals, healthcare centers, universities, in exchange for mining concessions and so on across Africa and so on. So they have been, and they have, you know, an export-import bank and a development bank of their own that helps facilitate these deals and provide finance in these deals. So they, it's not completely new. It's actually the outcome of an ongoing development that China's been a leading part of.
It's quite frustrating and depressing seeing our own taxpayers' money and our politicians, people we vote for, causing this chaos across the world, causing massive destitution. Do you think that there is any light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely positive in all this. The thing we have to bear in mind, like when I say that the West is in a phase where it's destroying and devastating country after country, adopting a kind of slash and burn policy of destroying countries so they can't function as independent regional powers. What we have to bear in mind, yes, of course, that's all very depressing, but it's driven by what is essentially a very positive development in the world, which is the declining ability of the West to continue to extort resources from the rest of the world. And this system is this 500-year-old kind of system, way of doing business that Europe and then North America have developed, of really extorting and exploiting the rest of the world to facilitate their own growth and development. This is what's really under threat now, and this is what's actually driving these desperate policies of what I call divide and ruin. So we mustn't forget that this is a very positive development, one that should be supported, the decline of Western manipulation and extortion around the world. And what they're trying to do is kind of claw back some of their influence with these policies. So obviously that makes it a very dangerous time. If you look at the Nazis were at their most dangerous after Stalingrad, after the balance had tipped, after they started losing the war. That's when they started adopting literal slash and burn policies. Nevertheless, that was driven by the fact that they were losing the war, and that was good. And that's the same situation we're in today, we're moving towards a multipolar world, and that's a good development. And what we in Western countries need to really focus on is understanding that's a good development, not be driven towards a kind of fascistic type mindset which tries to claw back the kind of old privileges, but instead not allow the decline of West to be only taken out on the poor, which is what our government's trying to do now, is to say, okay, well, the West's in decline, therefore no one can have any public services anymore, etc. No, we need to reorganize Western societies, accept that it's not fair that the West should dominate the rest of the world, accept that we want a more equal world, and that's a good thing, and that's a just thing, and we need to reorganize our societies in a way that they don't depend on exploiting the rest of the world, and that, that actually the you know that the rich are taxed fairly, and that that we reorganize our society in a way that that copes and contributes to this positive development, moving towards more global equality and justice, rather than trying to claw back old privileges and things like that.
The trouble is, we live in a nuclear age, don't we? And the Western powers, the Europe and the United States, the NATO powers, are almost like a kind of cornered animal. They're extremely powerful. They're starting to lose. Is there not the possibility they might lash out?
They are lashing out. They are lashing out, and you're absolutely right. So, like I say, although there's the positive element, it's the when they become at their most dangerous, when these powers are in decline as well. So, yeah, absolutely. We need to be very wary, very careful, especially with what's happening in places like Ukraine. I mean, the West has been acted appallingly in Ukraine. US and Britain have basically supported a coup there, led by fascist militias. They then encouraged that coup government to integrate those fascist militias into a new national army called the National Guard, which they're unleashing against any resistance to that coup. And that's what we're seeing playing out in Ukraine right now, all the time, whilst accompanying it with a sort of crescendo of anti-Russian propaganda. This is all very dangerous developments. So absolutely, you know, these things go hand in hand. When a powerful, exploitative ruling power is in decline, that's a positive development, but it's a dangerous development as well. So we do need to be careful.
Well, that was a masterly explanation of the current geopolitical balance of forces, Tony.
Also, this biggie this week, isn't it, the Global Development Bank. Do you think it's going to work or not?
It's bound to work in the end, but as he says, declining Western powers are determined to try and frustrate it.
OK, time to sign off. Time for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That was leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Bishopston, Daniela Radice. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for a Friday drive time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, pro-Russian rebels inside Ukraine are being blamed for bringing down a Malaysian passenger jet with a ground-to-air missile, killing all 298 passengers on board. President Obama says evidence indicates it was fired from an area considered a separatist stronghold. He's calling for a credible investigation.
This was a global tragedy. An Asian airliner was destroyed in European skies, filled with citizens from many countries. So there has to be a credible international investigation into what happened.
European monitors went to the scene earlier but have said they weren't able to move around freely. Tributes have been paid to the victims, 10 of them British. They include two Newcastle United football fans, John Alder and Liam Sweeney, who were following their team to New Zealand.